Okay, folks, any questions?
Questions, comments? I mean, obviously, I was trying to cover a lot of stuff. I was trying to do a Dostoevsky 101 and make it interesting and slightly original and relate it directly to the SPGB. So I was trying to cover a lot of stuff, and there's so much stuff I couldn't cover. So, yeah. Ah.
Is what you're saying proposing a different model of argument such as
maybe. I've got to the stage now in my life where I think Keats called it negative capability, when you don't have to decide on, you're quite happy to, I don't know, be overwhelmed by the complexity of stuff and not necessarily conclude anything particular at any one point in time. I don't know. Possibly. I think from using a rational argument about the experience of the propaganda model, it hasn't actually been very successful by its own terms. So by its own logic, it hasn't seemed to have worked. Now, I'm not saying I know what the answer is. I'm just drawing a very obvious rational inference from the data. Could there be another way around it? Yeah, I think if you guys went out and flogged Dostoevsky novels, you'd probably have as much of people coming back saying, well, you know, let's have a discussion about politics or philosophy or religion, and that's probably where you might find people, that might be a profitable grounds for gaining, I don't like that word, converts, horrible, isn't it? Sounds, people who, you need, the socialist movement requires people who think in the round. And like I said in the talk, I think the SPGB is very, very good and very proud of itself. This is socialism, this is capitalism, this is that. And that did attract me at one point. I just find it a little bit limited. It misses out so much. And it's the stuff that you can't say, which is what's missing. That's what I was trying to say. It's the stuff that we can't, the messy stuff, but stuff we can't, that operates underneath the surface, which we can't necessarily write down in written form or articulate it or draw a picture of it or something. You know, it's that's what's missing. So I don't know. I think it might be worth you guys looking into different art theories as to how communication works, maybe. I don't know. I'm just putting it out there. No idea at all. I mean, I'm not criticising because I haven't got anything to offer in this place. But I am criticising, but I'm criticising myself as well. So maybe, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, we've got trouble selling 1.50 standards. I don't know how we're going to get on selling Dostoevsky novels.
Oh, that's just an example.
You know, we talk about, you know, you've got this guy in the book Crime and Punishment. He kills a poor brother, kills a sister in the execution of the dean. I mean, the thing, what I like about the Socialist Party is it's forensic. It took me to ask the question, why? Well, we're looking at a society that's deeply irrational, deeply socially unhygienic. So therefore, it has to be reproduced every day by people who are infected by these conditions. They're conditioned to think in that way, and they're going to do all sorts of different things. And there's also something going on in all these experiences of conflict, reports of conflict, that is actually the cause. Why is it happening? Well, it's happening because in those societies and in our society, well, what we've yet to achieve is the discovery of our common identity as human beings. I saw on my Facebook page come up, there was this picture sent by some very nice lady who's very well-meaning. There's a picture of the Dalai Lama being ever so perfect. And what he's supposed to have said was, you know, we are all members of one family. And the world is our home, and underneath it's got like the holiness, this holiness, the Dalai Lama. Well, I've written underneath, I've been saying that for years, and who calls me your holiness? No, if anybody, you know, that's it.
Well, some have, Daddy.
But that's it, and we are members of one human family. We never ever get any lessons when we're in school about what it is to be human. We get loads and loads of lessons of what it is to be employable, to be a worker, but never what it is, nothing about our human essence, which Marx was going on. Mm. So this is the reason why we have this conflict. This is the reason why we find it really, really, really difficult to convince our fellow humans that it's in their interest to live like a member of a human family, bringing a cognitive ability, taking according to needs. And another thing I'd like to pick up on, you said that Marx and Dostoevsky were kind of similar in a way.
Mm. Well, in some ways.
Well, I think there's a marked difference in that Marx discovered his socialism in the early 1840s in France by his association with French workers in Paris. And he wrote the 1844 manuscripts, Paris manuscripts. Well, he never turned into a conservative. He never repudiated the core of like what he wrote in those manuscripts and his early life as a socialist. He developed it.
Mm.
Whereas Dostoevsky, you know, was different.
Well, he developed it in a different way. I'll put it that way. I mean, from a Marxist point of view.
So my point is, Dave, is that all this conflict has a cause. In that it is a lack of a common identity, because it's dead simple. You cannot abuse, you cannot exploit or oppress, let alone kill somebody that you identify with.
Mm.
If you properly identify with somebody, then it's like hurting yourself. Well, you damage yourself.
I think the thing
is, that's a totally irrational thing to do.
I think the thing is, Daddy, you always remind me of you're similar. Your approach is more towards the, I don't mean this in a pejorative sense, the utopian side of the party, which I think would be more congruent with Dostoevsky than perhaps other people, in the sense that you're very on the emotional side, which is what I was trying to get across.
No. All this is based in fact.
Yeah, I know it is. I'm not saying it's not. No, I'm talking about your orientation.
You can't get emotional. I mean, would Marx refer to socialism as the solution to the root of history and knowing itself to be that solution?
Yeah.
If you can't get emotional and energised and assertive.
Please understand. I'm not criticising you.
Being sentimental or anything.
No, there's nothing wrong with being a bit sentimental. I know you accused me of that once when I went to visit Marx's grave. And you said sentimentalism is
a backlog of
the yeah, yeah, that's it. Yeah, I remember that very well. But no, my point is that you're more in, rhetorically at least, let's put it that way, more in the utopian tradition, which would, I mean, the Dostoevsky stuff, even his mature stuff, was still very utopian. And that, so in that, although you and he would be coming at it from different angles, in terms of language, in terms of mentality, I think you'd find a lot of common ground. Other comrades, maybe not so, because if you're pushing a very rationalistic line, which you don't really do, I mean, I don't think, not in, you do, but by default, but your orientation rhetorically is emotion. I don't think that's a bad thing. I used to, but I don't anymore. And I'm saying that is congruent with what Dostoevsky was doing.
I mean, if I don't want to dominate, and I'll finish here. If you think...
That's a compliment,
that trying to convince people or create a society, as what SPG is trying to do in its own small way, acknowledges our real identity as human beings. Now, if you think that's utopian, I'm going to have to disagree with you.
Well,
I mean, it's
potato,
it's,
potato.
It's radical. It's hyper.
Doesn't make it bad because it's utopian.
It's not utopian.
Whether it is or whether it isn't, it's not really the issue. I mean, the point is, I'm saying that when people come together and when people discuss an ideas, we need to understand that people may come with baggage, they may come with certain rationales in their heads about I believe this and I believe that and all the rest of it. But when people start talking as human beings, which is now I'm starting to use your kind of language, barriers can fall. But barriers can only fall if people are prepared to find common ground. That common ground can be beneath the rational argument, if you see what I mean. So you could be talking to, you've had lots of very good conversations with some Christians. Have you?
No.
Yeah. How many other members of the party do you think, in comparison to yourself, have managed to do that?
Oh,
wow. I don't want to labour the point.
Most of us.
Okay, but I'm saying Danny's particular approach, which is infamous, and I've used his videos to more than anybody else's to push ideas forward, is because his approach, I'm saying his psychological approach, it operates in that area whereby you can come from different positions and have a conversation. More, I mean, compare it to the old erstwhile friends in socialist studies group. I mean, they're very sort of dogmatic, very it's like this, and all the rest of it. But you don't do that, and I applaud you for it. So, I mean, I'm trying to pay you a backhanded compliment. I'm trying to say that there are different ways of getting the message across, and yours is not a typical one, and that's why you do a useful job.
Would you do that?
Yes, a couple of related questions. I'd like Dave to expand on how he understands party members who join, never having read Dostoevsky, possibly never even having heard of him.
Yeah.
And the other part of the question is, why isn't the party full only of members who've read Dostoevsky? Whether, you know, people that are walking up and down the high street, you pull them in and say, have you read Dostoevsky? And they say yes, why aren't they members of
Well, it? I'm not saying, Green, that reading Dostoevsky turns you into a socialist. I mean, the idea is the opposite. What I'm saying, I mean, if you read the Bukowski poem, which is on your chair, he actually says, you know, millions have never heard of him, and let alone read him, or whatever the phrase is, and ultimately it doesn't really matter, but I know he did this for me. Now, in terms of whether or not other people, party members, I'm not saying people have to, I'm not saying, I mean, I could do a talk on why socialists should read Tolstoy, why socialists should read, I don't know, whoever, Chekhov. List could go on. It's about understanding that ideas develop in the round rather than in a linear fashion. So, no, it's not a prerequisite for people to read Dostoevsky. It's something to think about. It may work, it may not. I mean, I'm not suggesting, by the way, that people should read Dostoevsky and will they necessarily become socialists. That's not supposed to happen. I don't suppose it would happen. But I'm thinking, with some people, exposure to that type of writing may be allow them to connect to something which is not notionally separate. That's what I'm saying. So I don't know is the answer. Yeah, it's always a good idea. Ignorance is never a good thing in itself. Marx said that. Always read as much as you can, as you know. And Dostoevsky is no exception. But it's not. I don't see it as a luxury, as something, an indulgence that isn't essential. I think reading in the round and being knowledgeable in the round is as important, if not more important, now than I used to. I used to have a very sort of a utilitarian approach, particularly while I was in the party. You read in order to understand the case better, to put it across better. And I'm challenging that kind of logic. I guess I'm challenging logic, actually. Yeah. What's been a shady grounds, isn't it? Shaky grounds.
Steve. Yeah, I just want to talk about that clip.
Yeah.
I mean, as a socialist, I don't believe in the great man theory. Mm. It's spurious.
Of course.
It's bourgeois ideology.
Yep.
And it has its origin in Thomas Carlyle's essay on heroes and the heroic in history.
Big influence on the Russians.
Yeah. So as a socialist, I question that actually great men impose themselves on history. And I want to quote Marx from the 18th Brumaire. Men make their own history, but they do not make it just as they please. They do not make it under circumstances chosen by themselves, but under circumstances existing already, given and transmitted from the past. And also, there's a reference to Napoleon Bonaparte. I mean, Napoleon is always like held up as this great man. But even he, as a human being, recognised that he wasn't a great man. And I found a quote from him. He actually wrote in one of his diaries or some table talk that he indulged in. I found all the elements ready at hand to found an empire. If I had not come, probably someone would have done like me. A man is but a man, but often he can do much. Often he is a tinderbox in the midst of inflammable matter. His power is nothing if circumstances and public sentiment do not favour him. I think it's to Carnap wrote a book about the sort of like the great man theory. He pointed out that there was loads and loads of generals who were basically just vying for position to become first consul in France at the time of just after the revolution. But yeah, I mean, the great man theory, I think it's a great literary sort of conceit, you know, and but as a socialist, it's anti-socialist, it's bourgeois ideology, and I don't support it at all.
Well, I agree. What you say about the great man theory is that's covered in Tolstoy's War and Peace. I mean, he talks about, you know, circumstances being the main, well, the prime mover as to why great men do what they do. And he juxtaposes Napoleon against the Russian general, whose name escapes me now, who was a bit of a dodderer in the wars of 18... Yeah, that's the one, yeah. Of 1805 and 1812. And, of course, it's textbook is that Napoleon's going to win because he's got all the theories and all the ideas and the modern stuff, and he knows what he's doing. The other guy's a dodgy old Russian who doesn't really know his arse from his elbow. But Tolstoy's point is, through intuitive understanding of his men and of human nature, he was as good as Napoleon, if not better. Ultimately, he beat him. Do you know, Steve, when that quote was from Napoleon, was it by any chance after 1815?
Yes, it would have been on St. John.
Right, okay. Then I think that contextualises it a little bit. After he found out himself he wasn't a great man. In the same way as Raskolnikov found out he wasn't a great man. Although in the clip he still thought he might be. He wasn't sure. And the thing is, even at the end, there's this big argument about when he puts on the cross, Sonya gives him the cross, and he goes to Siberia, and he kneels down, before he goes to Siberia, he kneels down, kisses the earth and says, "I'm a murderer." It's not clear what he's repentive of. I mean, he says, I didn't kill the pawnbroker, I killed myself. I killed a principal. You know, there was this idea that she was still a louse. You know, she wasn't contributing anything. But he didn't have the right to do it. That's the point. He couldn't stomach it from the minute he did it, from during the act itself, it all goes pear-shaped. And I did read an essay by somebody who's very influenced by Hayek, who makes the point that, you know, rational planning, you know, the arguments, there's so many different factors involved that when you move out of the world, if you rely too much on reason, obviously Hayek was a rationalist, as everybody is, but the over-reliance upon rationalism means that you can't calculate, you don't involve all the intuitions, all the different things that can happen, you can't foresee, you can't plan for them. And Raskolnikov thinks he's got everything sorted. He does the murder and he realises the door's open. And then he's like this. Then he's trying to wash the blood off the axe, and then he's trying to get the right key in the lock, and he can't do that either. And then he's worried about, he hears noises outside. Then he realises he's spent a month thinking about this and he hasn't actually planned for anything. And his psychology is letting him down. He's not confident anymore. And he knew, and he teases himself afterwards in his own internal monologue. Or maybe the dialogues. Maybe there's two or three Raskolnikovs. He says, you know, I knew this was going to happen before it even happened. I know the kind of guy I am. What was I thinking of? Who was I to think I could do that? The next minute he's back into his, yeah, I did it. Then he's, oh no, I shouldn't have done it. And it's not for me to do. And I'm a louse. And it goes backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards. And that's the internal psychosis, I think, of him. And I think most people could, if they're honest enough, can understand that logic. I mean, we're constantly being arrogant about one thing and then being lacking confidence about it in another respect, all at the same time. Where's the rationality there? Where's the linearity? It doesn't exist.
Frank?
Yeah, very interesting talk,
Dave.
Thank you. What were the views of the Bolsheviks and Dostoevsky? And getting forward right up to date now, how would he have seen the lunacy in the Crimea, no, Russia, and Ukraine? And can you
see any association with rational thinking as to the events which are happening right here and now? In India, by coincidence,
in Russia. Okay, good question. What was the first part again, sorry, Frank?
Bolsheviks. Bolsheviks didn't like him.
They didn't like him?
No, for obvious reasons. But they found it hard to... I don't know a lot about this aspect of it, but they couldn't write him out. They had a whole band of literary critics sort of writing about trying to account for him. I mean, ideology, of course, in its purest form, always allows something to live and breathe. Even under the Tsar, under severe restrictions by which Dostoevsky was writing, there was a certain freedom to write and express yourself. I mean, they're not that stupid, these people. They just ban everything. They knew if they did that, I mean, they had the experience of 1825 in their heads, of the Decembrist rebellion. They knew that they had to appease the intelligentsia. They had to let the literary culture. And I guess the Bolsheviks' attitude was, well, we can't just write this guy out. We can't just say, I mean, you could write off Tolstoy as being a silly old pacifistic anarchist or something, but Dostoevsky is a different thing. So you kind of damn him with faint praise and then just say this was a construction of Tsarist, you know, ideology, early capitalism in Russia, and he was a reflection of that. I think there's a lot of criticism along those lines which has been written. Lukács makes the point that, although he was writing from a different position, there's this whole argument about when Roddy kills a pawnbroker, is it a worker killing the bourgeoisie? Is it an attack on the bourgeoisie? Does she represent the bourgeoisie? But so that's what I'd say on that one. In terms of what rationalism is there around today, not much. And I say at the end, I'm not sure that Dostoevsky's anti-rationalism was any better. If you've got a messianic viewpoint about Russia's particularity, I mean, that's a strange position for an intelligent person to hold, isn't it? And you might want to say it's slightly crazy. Oh, and it is crazy. It's mad. But so how would he make sense of the Crimea? Well, there was a Polish rebellion in the 1860s, and he was wasn't very progressive about that, actually, from what I remember, what I recall. Because although he tried to combine a sort of a Russian Slavophilism with a unification of the world at the same time. So you've got this constant, I need to know more about this, but you've got this tension between what Russia can unify the world with its example. For him, the West was decadent, and Catholicism, which dominated in the West as far as he was concerned, was individualistic, believe it or not. And it was decadent, and he said the Western socialists can't achieve socialism in the West because Western society isn't set up for it. You can only have a form of socialism, ironically what he was talking about, native soil conservatism, you can only have that form of socialism by the Russian example. And a lot of Russian writers do this. They're very, very peculiar about Russia's intellectual and political social development. So in the case of the Crimea, I suppose if he came back from the dead, he'd probably be supporting Putin. But maybe not. I mean, it depends if he thought that Putin was the real deal. Don't forget, the native soil people were very pragmatic. They didn't just slavishly follow a Slavist line. They were capable of saying either Petersburg nor Moscow, but international native soil. It's like they were like the kind of Trotskyists of the Slavophile movement. They might have been critical. They said, well, yeah, what's he doing in the Crimea? Or perhaps that's not the way to do it. I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised if he supported it either. So yeah, I'm not saying Dostoevsky's got the answers. I think he raises lots of questions that we can find useful. But anyone who puts an answer forward, have you noticed that? When you read a theorist, a novelist, or a philosopher, when they're asking the questions, it's all good. As soon as they start putting solutions forward, that's when it gets weak. And I think that can be said of even socialists. We're great on the critique. And when we put forward, when we do this quantum leap about what the new society is going to look like, and then we try to desperately relate it to rationalism, but we find the rationalism stretching itself a bit because we don't really know what it's going to be like. We can only infer it, and we're into utopianism of something like that very, very quickly, potentially, and the rationality goes out the window. So the connection between utopian thinking, Dostoevskian thinking, Marxist thinking, I'm saying, once again, at certain levels, are kind of close. They don't sit like this. They do intersect, particularly on the psychological level, which is something you don't normally get in philosophical discussion. What occurs on the philosophical level, the space between the rational and the meta-rational, that's really what I'm talking about. So, did you ever say something else, Frank? Was that it?
Was it used term, Russia is an enigma?
That was Churchill. A mystery wrapped in an enigma, or an enigma wrapped in a mystery, I can't remember. Something like that. That's what I mean, that's what it is.
In my meta-rational.
What lies outside the rational?
Or the irrational, in other words.
Well, possibly. I mean, all those feelings that you have that you can't really account for logically is how I put it. So in other words, if anybody here has ever sort of, I don't know, looked up at the sky and said thank you or something, I do that. I don't even believe in God. I feel the need to do it sometimes. Who am I talking to? Don't know. But that thing, that quality, that thing you can't box up, you can't define, you can't chop up, you can't put a graph to it. It's not logical, but it exists, it's real, we all experience it. That's what it is.
That's nature.
Yeah, look, everything's nature.
That's it.
Don't want to be all spin-nosy.
The thing is, we are alienated from our nature. That's why when you describe that experience, people can't intellectualize it, can't understand.
Possibly, yeah.
But when you actually, was it got a fellow called Nick Greiser? He said that a lot of people when they look up at the universe on a clear night, they say they feel very very small. And I know exactly what he was going to say next, because it's the same with me. Every time he looks up at the universe, he feels so big. And so do I, because I realise that I'm part of that. Every atom of my body has come from an exploding star, supernova.
Yeah.
And that's what people feel when they can't put a finger on this feeling. They can't. It's the opposite of alienation, this kind of intimacy.
Yeah.
Now, once you figure that out, then you can really be intimate. You know, I mean, not to an infinite level. I mean, the more you know, the more you can do. The better you know, the better you can do. The more you look, the more you can understand. But that's what it is. It's our connection to nature and everything around us. That's what people are alienated from, because that's absolutely essential for capitalism to continue. We can't have people who understand who they are and their connection, not only to nature, but to their fellow human beings. I mean, all society is a social relationship.
I mean, that's a good point, Danny. I mean, I'll say this. In terms of alienation, I did make the point that the Russian intelligentsia was an alienated milieu.
Well, they have to be.
And they were. And a lot of Dostoevsky's novels, particularly, there's one called Notes from Underground, which is on the list. It's about an alienated office worker. It's considered by some to be the first existential, after Kierkegaard perhaps, modern existential work. And Raskolnikov was clearly alienated. Like I said in the talk, I would like to be able to relate Marx's theory of alienation to these questions, including Dostoevsky himself. A guy goes to prison, he's about to be shot, as Bukowski says, and then they give him a reprieve. And rather than be negative, he embraces life. He goes to the prison. He's with these people he just can't relate to. He finds them disgusting and repulsive. And then he feels a need to relate to them. And this is where it gets a bit interesting, I guess. Why does he feel this need to relate? Why does he start fantasizing, projecting his political hopes and dreams, or his social or literary hopes and dreams, on these people who hate him? What's going on there psychologically? Alienation certainly must, and estrangement certainly must be part of that. So I think alienation is key to understanding not only Dostoevsky the man, because he was utterly alienated most of the time. He had lots of personal problems in his life and all the usual story. And it comes out, the frustration and the alienation comes out in the novels. And personally, I find that really helpful. I like to read stuff like that. That's why Adam made the point he made to me privately earlier. He said, this is a guy who was, the philosopher of suicide, whatever the phrase was used. Well, yes and no is the answer. There is that element to it, but the solution isn't suicide. The solution is life. And it's life affirming in a paradoxical sort of way. You see what I mean? It's not linear. It has a very interesting quality to it. That's why you guys should definitely read it, because when you're going to work in the mornings and you're on the tube, reading Dostoevsky can be a great help. It certainly helped Bukowski. He says it got me through the factories and past the halls.
Have you seen the tubes in the morning in London?
I'm on the tubes in the morning.
You don't even get a seat.
I know.
Never mind, read.
Tell me about it. I make sure I do. I make sure I read. I wave the flag for reading. And I tell people to turn their music down as well.
Pass by the hand up. Sorry, Patrick.
Yes, yeah. Right. Well, I certainly wouldn't argue for ignorance, to relearn everything that you can. But I think I can manage perfectly well without prosperity.
You can, of course.
Ideas. I'd like to comment on what I call the socialism as a nice idea approach. the human family that Danny has, and I can really sort of amused by the fact that he had the photo of the Dalai Lama sent to him, because I've sometimes said to him that yours is a religious
Yeah, that's what I was saying earlier. Yeah.
Yes. Well, for my money, I prefer the class approach. You know, not the socialism, is it? It's a tremendous idea. It's not just a nice idea, it's a brilliant idea, but it isn't enough. It's like the horrors of war is not enough to stop war. It ought to be, but it isn't. But there are all sorts of other reasons why it doesn't. But I think that the class understanding, the understanding of the working class, call them what you will, the people who do all the work, to see what is in their material interest and seeing their material interest. That is what we need for to move forward, to understand that. And the logic of understanding the material interest leads on to the solution. The solution is the abolition of this system that deprives people of their surplus value. The logic leads to the abolition of this basing of it with one where the means to produce are owned in common by all humanity. Then we can have the nice idea bit of it coming along, you know, in due course. But really, you've got to get the material interest, and if fiction helps you to get the picture, well, that's okay. But really, the picture comes from people's lives. They've got to look at how they live. And what doesn't happen, dissatisfaction of the life, and see the logic where the solution lies.
I agree with you.